Kia ora, welcome to the Power Up podcast, powered by Venture Taranaki and produced by Raw Collective. Season 4 has even more innovative, driven entrepreneurs doing amazing things in a variety of sectors. This series not only highlights the strength and diversity of entrepreneurship within Taranaki, but it's also a library of real-life case studies for budding business people to learn from. Taranaki business founders lift the curtains to tell honest stories of how they've got to where they are. We talk about their wins, their challenges, their inspiration, and their breakthroughs. And at the same time, we reflect on the reality of growing and running a business in Taranaki. We talk about how the unique natural and economic landscape has fueled both enterprises and lifestyles and empowers founders to be at their best. I'm David Downs, and this is the latest in a series all about flourishing Taranaki businesses and thriving Taranaki people. Nau mai, haere mai, we welcome you to hear all about our enterprising future like no other. Green Meadows Beef is a pioneering beef production company that cuts out the middleman and sells direct to consumers. It was a highly innovative model at its inception and has since exploded all over the world. Green Meadows Beef is run by the Carey family from their Opanaki farm. General Manager Nick Carey gave up his career as a lawyer to lead the operation, which now has more than 20 staff and has produced more than 1 million packages of sausages, burgers and steaks for customers in New Zealand and around the world. As well as the farm, Green Meadows Beef has its own production facility and export operation. It sells through its own website and is in New Zealand supermarkets. It has a focus on high-quality products that influences everything they do, from best practice stock management to brand collaboration and constant innovation. Well, Nick, welcome. Where have you come from this morning?
Thank you. I've come from work.
Yes.
Which is on Kateri Road, kind of near the Valley Shopping Centre.
Okay.
We've got our value-add manufacturing plant located in New Plymouth.
Okay, because the farm itself is Opanaki, is that right?
Correct, yeah, just about 5K south of Opanaki, which is where the Green Meadows Surf Break is.
Ah, is that the name I was going to ask you?
So most people just think it's one of those, sounds lovely, idyllic.
Yeah.
You know, as you would for
sounds like ChatGPT came up with that name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is quite funny. I did put something into ChatGPT the other day and it did come back with Green Meadows as an example of a possible name.
Yeah. Good name for a farm. Oh, very good. And so you've been involved in the meat industry for a while, but you're originally a lawyer, I noticed.
I am, yeah. I think you've had a couple of other types of reformed lawyers. Well, everyone always says that. They go, oh, you must have really hated your law job to leave to start a meat company. And it was quite the opposite, really. I thought I was probably going to be a lawyer forever.
Yeah.
And then I think the turning point was I was trying to do a property settlement at lunchtime and people were phoning me with freight questions like, where's my meat order?
Doing a side hustle at the time?
Yeah. Oh, right. Side hustle, what, 11 years ago before hustles were even invented. It was just skiving off.
That's right.
I think that was sort of the turning point of
I really can't be doing this. I'm charging this guy $600 a minute and over here I'm trying to move some meat around. Yeah,
so that I don't lose money on that transaction.
Oh, so tell us about those early days. What was it like when you first set it up? Why did you do it as a side hustle to start with?
Yeah, so my father really had the idea of taking the cattle that he farmed or finished and selling them direct to market. He found a website in Australia and said, I want to do that.
Right.
So I helped him build a website with a web development company, et cetera. And we launched it and, you know, had a few friends and family buy and then nothing really happened. So we sort of sat around and I didn't have a mortgage at the time. I hadn't really been done an OE. So I was like, oh, well, if you pay me, I won't mention it because it was a pittance. if you pay me that sum of money each year, I can probably give up my job and give it a shot and see what happens. So I sort of committed to 2 years and here we are 11 and a half years later.
Still being paid a pittance, yes, just for the record. Come on, Dad, put your hand in your pocket.
Look at that, yeah.
but that first conversation is pretty important. And, you know, did it take a lot of convincing or did you just think, actually, no, this is worth a shot?
I guess because I'd been involved in it from that idea stage and bringing it to life. You know, that was the exciting part of creating something and being a little bit younger than I am now. I mean, I don't know if I'd jump into something like this again if I was at this stage of my life. But I think because it was so early and we didn't have any preconceived ideas of where it could go or what sales we needed to hit, all of that things, it was kind of let's just give this a shot. And fortunate enough, because obviously this time on and we're building a business case for an investment at the moment in terms of us borrowing more money, and you know, it's some pretty lofty revenue targets that I need to hit to be able to justify borrowing that sum of money. So there was just no pressure. It was just hey, let's give this a shot. Yeah. Worst case, we've burnt some money on a website.
That's right. But the big difference, I suppose, then is the business model you chose, because most of the time meat companies grow the meat, grow the animals, obviously, and then sell through to a distributor and goes into the retail chain. You took a different route. Tell us a little bit about that direct-to-consumer model.
Yeah, we went to direct-to-consumer, I reckon maybe 1 to 2 years before the likes of MyFoodBag launched food delivery. So food delivery in New Zealand, there was no Countdown Online, no Uber Eats. Yeah, so there was not a lot of food transacting for the household online. So we were really early days. And to get the word out, the platform formerly known as Twitter was where a lot of parents at home were cooking and sharing what they were cooking.
Okay.
We actually started as a Twitter-focused business for our marketing, which, you know, this was Pinterest and Twitter days before Instagram and TikTok days. Everything changes and moves. So we could see that gap. We found some engagement and we started going direct to customers. Yeah. The business has then morphed now where our direct-to-customer market is maybe 15% to 20%, and then more of those traditional means
as well. You've kind of gone the other way around.
Exactly.
Started with that.
Yeah.
And when you first did that direct-to-consumer model, did it take a lot to set it up? Was there rules and regulations and ways of operating?
Yeah, usual food control plan type registrations that any food business needs to go down, which now we export as well. So we're governed by RMPs and Animal Products Act and all of the whole, boring things.
Lucky you're a lawyer.
Yeah, that basically involve many audits. I mean, the same as any build. Even if you want to sell, cookies at a bake sale, you have to have some form of registration. So not a barrier, it's just another
thing
hurdle
that you have to think about. Yeah. And how did you mentioned sort of Twitter as being your original thing. You know, were you unique at the time? How did you convince people who are just browsing through their feed to go, oh, actually, that's a good point. I need some sausages or whatever. That's quite a big jump.
And at the time, we also quite early on invested in PR.
Yeah.
And it was also in the time where traditional media was still making a lot of money.
Yeah.
And there were lots and lots of free placements that happened. So we were fortunate that people were talking about food on a platform like Twitter. Plus, we still got a lot of healthy traditional PR in those early days as well.
Nice.
Which obviously now we go out with a launch or something and it's fully paid as opposed to the...
It's pretty hard to beg, borrow and steal publicity now that you're an established business.
Yeah.
Let's talk a bit about the meat industry, because the meat industry can get all sorts of different reputations, from being, you know, high volume and therefore low quality to being really, really high quality and therefore incredibly costly. Where do you guys fit in that? You know, what's your sort of sweet spot?
Well, we started, and this is one of my father's favourite sayings is, we don't want to do more, we want more for what we do.
Yeah.
So sitting more in that premium space. But with anyone now, even if I'm helping anyone with a food business launch, I'm like, go to Pack and Save. If you sit in the category or the cabinet of where the product you want to sell and see who's picking up the products, what's going in the trolley, how can you achieve that mass penetration of the market? So while we've got our more premium brand, we also in recent times have launched a budget brand as well.
Yep.
It sits in the 3 for $20 bin at Countdown. So it's very much affordable protein for families, really. So we're trying to straddle that whole sector, just like we are with distribution models, where we've got online, we've got exports, we've got supermarkets, we've got restaurants and food service, etc.
Yeah.
We've also got super premium that we might export to French Polynesia. We've got everyday premium that we sell online, and then we've got the budget brand that's in Countdown, for example.
Fantastic. In the last few years, it's become, you know, consumers of any products, particularly food products, are becoming more aware of not just the quality or the taste, but more for things like welfare, sustainability, your impact. You know, how has that shifted and changed in your business?
It's definitely there, but I mean, COVID was a really great leveler of claims, for want of a better word.
Yeah.
You know, all the environmental packaging claims just went out the window during COVID, right? It was give me plastic on my fruit and veggies because I don't want anyone to touch it.
Sneezing it or whatever. Yeah.
And we've still obviously seen this now with cost of living and price pressures at the checkout is some of those more nice to haves, I think, and certainly in a product that is feeding people, kind of have dropped back a little bit in the last few years. So I'm sure it'll come back and it's all about, you know, rising incomes again and potentially lowering interest rates and more disposable income. It's all cyclical. So I'm sure it'll come back. But you know, what we're seeing right now is what can we do that's affordable to make sure we get our products in the mouths of as many people as we can.
But it's fair to say, I think that your farming and your practices already had quite a good basis in terms of sustainable practices.
Definitely. And we have very low stocking rates and it's all a total grass-based system. So all of the good standard Kiwi farming that we all try and get premiums for. And I know the whole farming sector has a long way to go to be sort of gold standard, but you know, compared to others in the world, we're all doing a really good job. So we've got all of that as the base. It's just how you also keep everything affordable and able to reach that mass
market. Sweet spot. And that's the thing, I think most Kiwis don't really realise the absolute high quality we have in the red meat sector and the grass-fed thing. You know, if you travel overseas, grass-fed is such a huge promotional point. But here we don't realise all our food's grass-fed, isn't it?
So, yes, exactly.
Yeah, talk about that.
And actually a lot of the meat that is available in traditional means, so supermarkets and things, is actually all export quality. There is good meat every day available in the country. So interesting about that grass-fed, we did sell in Japan for a time and you try and convince the Japanese to eat grass-fed beef when their whole generationally have grown up on eating grain only. Right. So you know, you go into a butcher shop in downtown Tokyo and you say, you know, grass-fed beef, and they bring you the leanest grain-fed beef that they find, that they can find, because it's just not something that they
used to. Oh, wow. Interesting. And not only grass-fed, but Taranaki grass. Is there something special in the air or the water or the soil or something, do you think?
We're very close to the sea and there is a prevailing westerly breeze most
days. I've
noticed
that when I fly in.
Oh, you were lucky that you could land.
Exactly.
That was good. So, you know, whether it's the volcanic soil, whether it's the salt spray on the land, you know, I guess the benefit of living here is it is a reasonably temperate climate, so grass grows well most of the year. It is always dry at some stage of the year. It's always wet at some stage of the year, but it's a pretty forgiving countryside, I would say.
And do you think that being from Taranaki or from New Zealand, even if you think about your export markets, is a benefit? And how do you use that part of your story?
Some markets, actually. So we do a weekly air freight to a supermarket chain in Singapore, and we're always battling competition from Australia because in the client's minds, New Zealand and Australian beef are pretty similar.
Yeah.
And you know, we try and tell them all.
Educate them.
Exactly.
They'll speak better. They don't cheat at sports.
But then the flip side, if you go to French Polynesia and Tahiti, there is no Australian beef. It's all New Zealand only.
Yeah.
So we try not to fight any of those macro issues and just sort of go with what we get. And actually we've focused a lot more on the Pacific as an export market rather than some of those sort of more lucrative Asian markets, just as a business decision. But I mean, I've just been in Tahiti recently and, you know, all of our point of sale materials all, you know, translated in French and it all looks great. And then the client said, oh, we need something to know it's from New Zealand. So I've got a nice little Fern Mark logo,
good,
obviously, sitting in there.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thought I'd put that plug in.
It's in my day job. It's my organization, the Fern Mark. Oh, that's awesome. Now, the Pacific is an interesting market for you because obviously you sell retail, but do you also go into food service, into hotels and things?
Yeah, so we've got sort of a three-pronged attach. So say in French Polynesia, it's air freight to a supermarket. The likes of Fiji and Samoa, it's more food service, burgers and things into hotels and resorts. And then some of the other markets as well are more kind of bulk products for catering and the like.
Yeah.
school lunches, anything.
Right. So that's how you get the volume through without.
Exactly.
Yeah, oh, good. You've also done collaborations, I understand, including a notable one with Michael Van Denelson. Is that right? Van Delson?
Yes.
Can you
tell
us about that one?
I guess that was really the start of our supermarket journey. We used to do lots of trade shows. We still do, but you know, field days. It's quite expensive to go to those sort of things. So we thought, oh, how can we make money at field days in the earlier days? So we contracted a local bakery here to make us pies because, you know, we were like farmers love pies. So we used to start, you know, kind of cooking pies at 5 o'clock in the morning, and we had one oven and that wasn't enough. So next year we had three ovens and that still wasn't enough, and I'd come out and have burns all up my arms. And
you're going, I'm a lawyer, I'm a trained lawyer, why am I burning
here I am.
My arms?
Well, I was temperature probing the pies, you know, so it was a pretty technical job. And that led us to meet Mike at field days because we soon worked out that there was this big glorious oven in the celebrity chef's cooking theatre that basically they weren't using. So
just
we
there
could,
for background.
Yeah. Right. So we could go in there and cook, you know, another couple of hundred pies and everything would be good. So, yeah, so Mike came over and had a chat and he said, oh, I think we should make a healthy burger. Do you want to do it? So, you know, various contractual negotiations and things. Later, we did launch a beef and beetroot range with him in supermarkets, which lasted about 5 years. We recently retired it. But that was a really great way of getting traction into supermarkets. It's always hard to launch a new brand or a new product in supermarkets.
Yeah, you've got to stand out, don't you, in those cabinets?
And just because it's the same with that. Why is New Zealand the best meat in the world? It's like, well, why is your product the best in the world or best in the land? Because, someone else is always willing to kind of bring you down.
You sort of talked about the origins of Green Meadows, but you've kind of, through this last few minutes, talked a little bit that's given me a clue that it's gone really well. Like, I just read here you're doing 1 million packs of sausages, burgers, steaks, 20-something staff. How do you compare now the business now to where it was 11 years ago?
Yeah, well, 11 years ago, we used to just have, it was me and a butcher and my parents who, you know, I'm very fortunate that they still help out today because, you know, those jobs that you just kind of just need someone to do, they're very
good. The pies, would you, Dan?
Yeah, they're very good at. Yeah. I guess launching into the supermarket, that was actually a really costly exercise for us because building a brand and working out margins and ensuring your freight's all correct is actually quite a difficult process. And then we had COVID, which for a mail order business supplying food. You know, we had a database of 20,000 people that we'd collected at food shows and all of that that were just sitting there dormant that, you know, we sent out a newsletter on the first kind of day of the first hint of a lockdown and all of a sudden, you know, our website crashed with orders. And then we could see on Google Analytics every time the Prime Minister was about to speak or was speaking, there was always a spike in
Is that right? In
web traffic.
Wow.
You know, so that really shifted the business back towards the mail order from that. And then after that, we got into exports, which again is a costly tool. So I feel like while we've grown, it's only sort of really been in the last 12 months that I think we've grown in the right direction. And by that, I mean each bucket is where it needs to be. Because if you've got, you know, one of those buckets too high, let's say it's doing lower margin food service products, well, then it's going to sap away that total margin. So we've seemed to have found that sweet spot.
Found the balance.
For now, but
it'll change again.
Exactly. And as
time.
I talk about needing to grow again and borrow more money, it just sort of, you think, okay, right, we're starting again.
How many countries do you export to now?
6 to 7, but we're just sending a sample card into the Bahamas next week, which...
You just sound like you're just making a list of the places you want to go on holiday and then trying to get an export.
The third person that has sent that,
for
actually.
For the record, he has a very good suntan.
Yeah, I do. That was from French Polynesia. Don't tell my wife that it rained the whole time.
And the family business dynamic is another interesting one. So not only are you running a successful large business, but you're doing it with family. How does that change the dynamics? You know, does it change the dinner table conversations?
Yeah, well, I've got two older brothers. They don't work in the business. They, you know, sit more in terms of an advisory role.
Yeah.
So very much from the start, it's been mum, dad and myself, which has been pretty cool in terms of working alongside them. But with my brothers, my oldest brother's 9 years older than me. So you know, he'd left for boarding school by the time I sort of worked out what was what in the world. So it's been actually a really nice thing from a family dynamic that we've had this chance to work together on something, and they all bring various skills and life experiences to the table. So they have mostly given me the freedom to do what I want.
Oh, I'm sure I've got an opinion every now and then.
Yeah, definite opinions. But I feel...
Do you have any like rules around Christmas dinner or anything like that?
We
like,
try, but it...
No
it,
shop talk.
Yeah, it always comes back to shop talk. Even, you know, the in-laws and things are like, please, no work talk. But yeah, something always pops up.
Oh, God.
Some idea or something.
So, Nick, you've grown a successful business, but presumably you've had some help along the way from others?
Yeah, definitely. We've got kind of a network of trusted advisors that we've worked with, a lot of them from the start, but also locally our regional development agency, Venture Taranaki, have been really supportive. I think at the early stage they were, I went to one of the startup type clinics and we got a business advisor. And even now we've recently, or in the last few years, been fortunate to get a grant which really started our export journey. So we used it to do some market development and then some consulting to invariably register us as an exporter. So without that help and support, it wouldn't have made that as easy as it was.
That's good. You've gone on to become a successful export business.
Yeah, and with, you know, one humble air freight customer of 2,500 or something, you know, you wouldn't really jump out to go that step. So you're very fortunate that we received that support.
And what's it like running a business from Taranaki?
I find it great from a work-life balance for both myself, but also the staff. And we actually have a really engaged and loyal workforce here, particularly in processing. There's a number of large companies here that are processing. So from a workforce perspective, it's great. I think one of our freight companies does say it's the third most expensive region in the country to freight
to move from
because you're always backloading back to Palmerston North. Yeah. So potentially with, you know, changes in road networks and things north, that may happen. But I mean, everything is so connected now. One of our digital agencies, the founder of there was just working in Mexico for a couple of months, and it's possible to do business anywhere. And when, you know, it's a beautiful day here today, it's not hard.
You got to skive off and do a podcast instead of working and then go for a surf or something.
Yeah, I wish, and I'll be home to the kids.
Yeah, well,
I'm waiting for that message.
What, I was going to ask you about that because you mentioned that you've got young children, so you've got life outside work as well, another dynamic.
Yes, yeah, and to be honest, that has been, well, most people would say I quite like working.
Yeah.
And quite like being able to work, you know, 16, 17 hours a day
you're one of those crazy people.
I need to. So that's been a challenge and I guess a frustration internally, you know, to try and be like, okay, 4 o'clock, I need to be home for that time.
Good discipline for you maybe.
Yeah. And the phone's still ringing and something's, you know, you're always late. Or I used to be quite organized, but just now everything's a circus.
Welcome to parenthood, my friend.
Yeah.
But what does the future hold now for Green Meadows? You've got a new brand, I think, Meat Street.
Yeah, so Meat Street's the value brand that I mentioned. We've got big plans to kind of build that while still building the Green Meadows brand, particularly in the export front is where we see it, as well as, I guess, keeping, as I said, those buckets all full locally as well. A big expansion, which actually allows us to automate a number of processes just through growing from the ground up. There's so many inefficiencies that I'm sure we can squeeze out.
Good.
And try and look to continue on the journey and stay based here.
Good. And raise a family and a business.
Yeah, hopefully. And then one day, I don't know. I don't know what happens next. I do think about that often, but
grow up.
Yeah, what would you do if you weren't working? Or weren't, you know, I get to go overseas, you know, every 6 to 8 weeks.
I know, it sounds like a terrible time. Your wife might listen to this. Careful. It's terrible when you have to go overseas and it's terrible. You miss everybody.
Yeah.
Now, final question for you. What's the best and worst business advice you've ever been given?
Yeah, it was actually one of my brother's bosses at the time said, you know, it takes 10 years to be an overnight success.
Yeah.
So that's always stuck with me and I feel...
Well, you're 11 years in 11, now and you sound and like you've just got it going on.
And like I said, about a year ago is when I felt like, oh, I think things are kind of where they're going, where they need to be.
Yeah.
And the worst, I think, I'd reflect back on this a lot in terms of the earlier days, you sort of jump out there and get advice, you know, you go to something and they say, oh, you need to get a strategic plan and you need to do this. It's almost like I find the worst advice is too much advice.
Right.
Rather than just getting out there and doing, failing fast or whatever. So, you know, if you are trialing a product, I always, you know, come back to that product-based businesses, you know, test it easily, go to a market and try it out on people. If, you know, it might cost you a couple of $100 rather than imagine the people that, you know, go and get strategic plans and think about everything and really perfect it, you can suffer over advice.
That's a good piece of advice. I wonder if that's over advice. Yeah. But anyway, it's good advice. Yeah. Hey, Nick, thank you very much for coming in and sharing your story. And you've made me hungry. I'm going to go get some lunch.
Yeah, no problem. The burgers next door are quite good.
Thanks. Thanks so much for listening. And a special thanks to Venture Taranaki for making this Power Up podcast possible. Highlighting Taranaki's success stories for others to learn from is just one way Venture Taranaki helps entrepreneurs to get ideas off the ground. If you're looking to start a new venture or want to power up your existing business, Venture Taranaki can help. With a wide range of services such as free startup clinics, advisory support, business mentoring, masterclasses, investment advice, and networking opportunities, VT is here to help you bring your idea to life. And in Taranaki, you can enjoy the like no other mountain-to-sea lifestyle. There's something for everyone, with stunning natural landscapes and a unique buzz about the place, with diverse events, arts and culture, and a thriving food and beverage scene. If you've got this far and you've enjoyed the episode, please rate it, review it, or subscribe for more. It helps others find us.